I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the latest episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're counting down the days to the 4th of July, so this week's theme is independence. After all, we're an independent food radio station.
HRN is a labor of love. Staff, hosts, and listeners all share the belief that storytelling can change the world, one bite or sound bite at a time.
We take a moment to ponder our founding mothers and fathers, specifically what they were drinking during the Revolutionary War.
Rum in various combinations with beer and cider would be the order of the day.
We highlight a story of self-sufficiency on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico.
The biggest thing we did was to start a lot of fermented vegetables because we knew the first thing to go would be refrigerator trucks coming to the island.
And we examine the challenges facing independent grocery stores across the U.S.
The struggle is real, but the future looks bright.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Phil Rosenthal, who is the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, which is the winner of 15 Emmy Awards. Now, Phil takes us to the most fascinating food destinations through the fantastic food travel shows called I'll Have What Phil's Having. And it received a broadcast media award from James Beard Foundation and the new show, Somebody Feel Phil. And he visited Tokyo on one of the episodes, and I was fascinated by his insight into the Japanese food culture. So today we'll discuss how Phil started the shows, what he discovered in Japan, and what is in common between a sitcom and a food travel show, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, I have a couple announcements. First, I'll be moderating a fun discussion about miso at MOFAT, the Museum of Food and Drink in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, on Thursday, July 12th from 6:30 to 8:30. The title of the event is The Multitudes of Miso, An Evening with Besso. And Michael Kyogoku, an executive chef, Emily Yuen of Besso, a charming Japanese restaurant in NoHo, will discuss the beauty of the Japanese superfood miso, how it is made, and how they use it at home and at the restaurant. The event includes a cooking demonstration and tasting. And tickets are available at mofad.org/events. That is mofad.org/events. And finally, the 22nd Sumo Stew is coming to New York on Tuesday, July 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Arrogant Swine in Brooklyn. As you may know, Sumo Stew is a seasonal live streaming event of sumo matches straight from Japan, and you can enjoy Japanese food from outstanding restaurants as you watch the matches. So it's going to be the biggest sumo stew ever, and the venue is outdoor for the summery weather. And this round of Sumo Stew will feature North Carolina barbecue-style whole hog chanko nabe in collaboration with Tyson Ho of Arrogant Swine. Tickets are available at sumostew.com. And that is sumostew.com. And for Japanese listeners, there is a $10 off discount code. That's Japan Eats. One word, Japan Eats. So now let's start a conversation with Phil Rosenthal.
Hello.
Oh, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, so you're originally from Queens, New York.
Yes.
Welcome back from LA.
I love it.
So, so what did you eat when you grew up in Queens?
Not very much. Not very much. My mother is a wonderful person. If you've seen the show, you see her, you see my father. But cooking was not her strong suit.
Mm.
She worked. My father worked. And so we didn't have a lot of time or money to make good things. So, for instance, any meat was going to be very inexpensive, and it was always gray and tough to chew. I used to say meat in our house was a punishment.
Oh, no.
Yes, that's what it felt like. And we didn't get a lot of fresh vegetables, and we didn't get, you know, the idea of having Japanese food was completely not even a possibility.
Mm.
Really?
Wow. I mean,
nothing. No ethnic food of any kind. They came from Eastern Europe, and that was the kind of ethnic foods that we had.
Mm.
The only thing I would say my mother did very well was her matzo ball soup, which I feature in the New York episode, because I don't want to just make fun of her cooking.
Hey.
I do exaggerate a little bit, because I get a lot of material out of it. But this she makes very well.
Mm, that's a little love. Love is there. So
that's right. That's right.
Right. And so you became a famous as writer and the producer of the super successful American sitcom TV series. Of course, everybody loves Raymond, which ran a total of 210 episodes over 9 years.
Yes.
So why? What do you think was the key to become so successful as a writer and a producer of a sitcom?
That's a good question. I guess if I boil it down, first of all, you have to be funny, I think. Mm. Otherwise, you don't have a chance. But funny is subjective. Do they have it in Japan?
I'm not sure.
We're in many, many countries around the world. Some countries have even taken the show and translated it into their language with their own actors.
Mm.
I made a documentary about this very thing when I went to Russia to help them translate the show and cast their own people. It's called Exporting Raymond, and it's quite a cultural exchange program.
Mm.
That's on Netflix as well if you want to see it.
Right. But well, I heard that there's no concept of sitcom in Russia when you brought the...
Exactly right.
That's crazy.
That's right. The form didn't exist there until The Nanny. Which was a little before us.
Mm.
And then Sony Pictures asked me if I would like to go and do my show there. And I said, yeah, if we can make it a documentary. Because that's interesting to me.
Right.
And it turned out well. And to answer your first question about why I think Raymond was successful, I chalk it up to one thing, relatability. Because we didn't do anything topical. There were no political jokes. There were no jokes about the celebrities of the day, and so you don't date the show. You want to be timeless, not timely, right?
Right.
So maybe that's why around the world it's still on, because we didn't do anything to date ourselves.
Right. I actually watched the YouTube and the episodes, and it's like regardless of what nationality or what age group, you laugh at the same time.
I get letters from Sri Lanka, people saying, that's my mother. Which is impossible because I only knew how to write my mother.
Mm. Well, actually, though, when I see your parents on your show, which we're going to talk about in a moment, I really thought, oh, that's like exactly my dad. He's going to say that too.
That's amazing, isn't it? Amazing how different people can appear to be and how we're all the same.
Right. So that's the relatability. That's the essence of sitcom.
Yes. Mm.
So so now you are a professional traveler, diner, cultural reporter. That's what I think.
Oh, nice.
Wonderful.
I've never been called a cultural reporter.
You really are, I think.
Oh, thank you.
So the shows, I'll Have What Phil's Having on PBS.
Yes.
And that was the first one. And the news, Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix. So how did it all begin for you to become a main character of a food travel show?
That's a great question, too. Because I did the documentary, I now was someone in front of the camera. Okay. Now, I studied theater in school, and I always thought as a child that I would be funny on camera.
Mm.
because when you're a child, you don't know that there's writing and producing and directing yet. You just see the people that make you laugh. And if you're like me, I wanted to just be them. And so I studied theater so I could do that. And while studying theater, I learned about writing, producing, directing, all things that I would do because I didn't have the stomach for trying to be an actor. I was never a serious actor. I'm probably not a very good actor. But I loved every aspect of show business, all these other things. And I found a way to make a living by writing. And now, because I did the documentary and I was now in front of the camera as well, people saw that and said they would like to see me go to other places. And that's when I could tell them about my dream of having a show where I go and try to inspire you to travel by showing you the best places in the world to eat as a way to get you to travel.
Right. Well, I think, well, I'm going to talk about the shows in a moment more deeply, but I think the reason I think your show is very different is you have the view as a producer, so you can think of the mind and expectation of the audience. I think that's what it is.
Maybe a little bit. You can't turn off that switch once it's been turned on, right? So there is that. There's the mind of the writer. There's the mind of the comedian. And there's the mind, I guess, of the tourist, which is what I really think of myself as when I'm doing the show, because I'm not a chef. So I have no expertise in cooking. I'm not a world traveler until you're seeing me in the show. So I am proudly and decidedly a tourist, which I think most of us are on the planet.
Right. Interesting, because I think there's so many food shows and it gets a little too analytical.
Yes.
It's very kind of fine dining oriented.
Yes, and many people are into this and want to learn from that point of view. And that's valid and great. And all the people that came before me, especially Anthony Bourdain, was a superhero, like a genius in this medium, reinvented the whole genre. The way I sold my show, the way I told them, you know, why they should do a show with me, was I said, I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
Right.
Which I think most people who would watch his show would say, he's amazing. I'm never doing that.
Right. Well, I saw you eating ants.
I did it. I did it. That was, you know, a tiny step out of my comfort zone to do that, to eat an ant in Tokyo at Den. Have you been to Den?
I haven't been, but I know the show. He's such an amazing person beyond cooking.
I love him. I loved him right away. And it's probably his personality that got me to taste this ant. So the plate comes, and it's a salad, a beautiful salad that you would be so happy to eat anywhere. On the plate were two black ants. And the first thing you think, if you're an American like me, is, oh, this, they should call an exterminator from the restaurant. They have a problem. No, they're there on purpose. Are they fake? Are they there for decoration? No, you're supposed to eat. Why would I eat that? Well, it tastes like lemon, he says. Oh, in that case, can I have some lemon? And he said, try it. And Yukari, who was sitting next to me, she said, you got to try it. It's really good. And she popped it in her mouth. I'm like, Yukari, no. And she she loved it. And so maybe I got a little brave because the cameras were on me. Maybe that does
it. You cannot chicken out. So.
You can't chicken out now. So I put this ant in my mouth. It was everything I could do to bite down on it. And I was like, oh no. And then it was like somebody put a drop of lemon on my tongue.
Wow.
So now I'm asking the chef, okay, so what did you do? You basted them in lemon so they taste like lemon? He says, no. These ants, not every ant, these particular ants, these specific ants from this part of this forest in Japan, these ants taste like lemon.
Wow.
Yes. Now, does it mean that now I look for ants everywhere? No.
Not in Brooklyn.
Not in Brooklyn. Not, I wouldn't pick up an ant at a picnic and eat it. But it was very interesting, the experience, and I'm glad I did it. Yes.
So do you think your doors are opening to more kind of interesting culinary world?
Yes.
Since you started doing the show?
Yes. They have to, because the more you taste and the more you're rewarded for tasting, like delightfully surprised by things that you didn't expect to be good, the more you want to try.
That's interesting. Because I think, you know, I think the majority of us tend to be scared. You travel, like, you don't want to eat something crazy and you don't want to get sick.
Of course.
So you're inviting us, join me, it's okay.
I'm afraid, naturally. And I feel like if you watch me go to these places and try these things, you say to yourself, if that guy can do it, I can do it. And that's all I'm here for.
Right. Thank you for doing that. So is there anything in common between producing a sitcom and a food travel show?
Yes, they're both storytelling. I'm telling a story. I am now combining everything I've learned about making a television show, right? The producing, writing, editing, even performing, storytelling, with the story I want to tell that means the most to me in life. I'm combining all the things I love in life. That is the subject of this show. The subject being family, friends, food, laughing, travel. All combined with what I know how to make a show. I'd even say that my show is part sitcom. Because what is a sitcom? It's taking a character and putting them in situations. So if I look objectively at myself in the show, I understand my persona, I understand who I am, and my producers, one of whom is my brother, who knows me very, very well.
Richard.
He understands that if he puts me with elephants, it's going to be funny and unusual for me. And so that now you have a sitcom without trying, given who I am and my quote-unquote character.
Right.
Now this same guy, let's see if he'll eat an ant. You know, I'm not thinking of that when I'm there. I really am experiencing it. I'm in the moment. There's no acting. I'm just being. But later in editing, I'm watching myself and I have to be objective. I have to look at that guy and see, oh, this makes sense for that guy.
Right. But I think the difference is you don't have a set cast members, right? So each time you go, you have to create a new kind of members.
So the other thing I learned from sitcom is that recurring characters start to produce audience loyalty. They like seeing the same characters. So how about my parents? They are the same in every episode.
Right.
And I Skype with them every episode. Now, I wouldn't do it if they weren't so funny. But they are funny, and they add value to the show. I would even say they're the best part of the show. Other people tell me that, too.
Right.
It's annoying.
How was your conversation, family conversation when you grew up?
Must be funny. It was either funny or it was yelling. Sometimes both.
So yelling over bad food or something like that?
Anything, whatever it was. You know, it's this kind of, I think, very relatable house where tensions run high. People have their problems that they bring in to the family, to the home. They don't want to, but the outside world gets in, right? And you take it out on whoever's available.
Right.
That's a family. And so you work through it. And as long as there's deep love underneath, you get through it.
Right. Nice. Okay. So by the way, I really look forward to the segment when your parents appear.
You like it.
Yeah, I really love that.
And look, you relate to it. This is what I've learned. If you're vague, meaning you try to reach everybody by not being specific, you're going to miss everybody. Because the thing that unites us is identifying with each other's specifics. So if you have a very specific Japanese way of living at home, and I see you go through a certain ritual, I'm going to relate to it. Not because I have that same ritual, but because you have a ritual. And I understand my rituals. So I relate just to the fact that it is a specific for you, I relate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So your parents, you say that my dad is like your dad, even though if you would look at both of them and the way they act, probably doesn't look that way on the surface. But you understand the thinking.
Right.
And the mother, who in any language, in any culture, is always going to be the mother.
That is so true.
Is always going to interfere, is always going to run the house, is always going to be the boss, right? These are universal things.
Right.
I think.
Yeah. So, and also, you know, you go to very exotic places, and then once you speak to your parents, like, you know, it's almost like you go on vacation, come back,
yes,
like, oh, this is my point of view. And
yes,
now looking at the experiences during this, like, foreign experience, then it's back to your own place.
Yes.
So it's kind of settling, like almost absorbing experience with your parents. And it's
That's
kind
right.
of taking into your daily life. It's going to sink into who you are. So
I try to relate to them what I'm going through.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you in stark contrast the differences,
mm-hmm,
but also the similarities,
mm-hmm,
of the cultures. Right?
Right.
It's funny, the Skype home is the modern day equivalent of the postcard.
Mm.
But now we can see each other and I can show you a mangosteen that I'm eating in Thailand, right?
Right.
And they can see it and understand it,
mm,
even, or try to understand it.
Right.
It's funny, you have these experiences, the audience has just seen you experience it, they may even understand it. Now try to explain it to your parents back home who haven't seen it yet.
Mm,
there's
right.
something funny about it, but also relatable. We've all been there.
Mm.
How do you explain something
right.
to your folks who can't possibly understand what you've just been through,
mm,
or what you're experiencing?
Right. So it's the right time for you to do the show. We benefit from all the technologies
yes.
and the connectivity.
Yes. Yes,
right.
And the connection is what the show's really all about.
Mm, right. So now you said that, so let's just talk about exotic place, Tokyo.
Yes.
So you went to Tokyo on one of the episodes
yes.
of I'll Have What Phil's Having.
Yes.
So, well, first of all, why did you choose Tokyo as one of the destinations?
Always wanted to go there. Mm. I love the Japanese culture. Absolutely love it. I love the food. And in New York, it's funny, we just happened to be recording another show right across the street from the first place that I ever had sushi in 1981.
Wow.
Hatsuhana
in
Manhattan on
wow.
48th Street. They had a dish that I'll never forget. It was little crabs that had been flash fried and were standing on their legs. They were bright orange. And they were four of them on a black lacquer plate.
Right.
Unforgettable. You pop the whole thing in your mouth and they crunch like light popcorn. Like this. I never forgot it.
Mm.
It was the most unusual, exotic, most beautiful thing I ever ate.
Mm.
That one dish, to me, personified Japanese cuisine, Japanese culture.
Mm.
My joke is, in Japan, in Tokyo, if you go to the pharmacy and get a stick of gum, they're going to wrap it for you as if it's for your 100th birthday. There's such care and such attention to detail.
Mm.
And I learned this maybe on my first day in Tokyo, maybe my second day. My first day, I was bombarded by the main square, Shinjuku. How do you say it?
Shinjuku.
Shinjuku.
Mm-hmm.
The crosswalk of...
Oh, that's a Shibuya... The biggest,
Shibuya
the cross,
market.
Yeah,
Shibuya crosswalk.
Cross yeah.
Intersection.
Mm-hmm.
How many streets coming together? Six?
Okay. At least.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. Loud, noisy. Mm. You get in the subway. You go, you know, for a half hour on the subway. You get out. There's another one.
Right.
It doesn't end. It seems like chaos to me.
Mm.
And then when you go and have the meal... And you have this beautiful detail, or you go to the hotel and you see the beautiful detail, or in every other block is a beautiful garden, so perfect. It taught me a life lesson, which was none of us can control the outside.
Right.
But what we can control, we make as beautiful and perfect as possible.
Interesting.
That to me, maybe this is just my point of view being an American, and maybe it isn't even the Japanese intention, but this is what I'm getting from it. That's the lesson that I took away.
Mm.
And I thought it was beautiful.
Right. So I'm sure our audience, listeners, want to know more specifically. So So you visit multiple eateries in Tokyo, including
yes.
super high-end Michelin star restaurants
yes.
to casual ramen shops. So maybe you can share some
sure.
Like top three most memorable
okay.
or shocking experiences.
Yeah, so Narasawa is unforgettable, a brilliant, brilliant, transportive meal. You mm. see it in the show.
Mm, so it's Narasawa, it's a chef by chef Yoshihiro Narasawa.
Yes. And, have you been?
Nope, but I know the chef.
You do.
Yeah.
I think you have to go once in your life to experience this. The first dish comes out. It's the forest floor. It's on a cut tree bark, and everything is on the plate to emulate the forest. It's all edible. There's even stream, and you hear suddenly the sounds of a stream and birds, and I'm like, oh, that's smart. They put some sound chip in the plate, in the wood.
Mm.
No, it's a speaker, and they're transmitting a broadcast from the forest. You're listening to it live. I couldn't believe it.
Mm.
I've never experienced anything like this.
So it's appealing to your five senses.
That's right.
Mm.
That's right. Appealing to all the senses. And it's all about nature, the restaurant. Mm. So everything you're having is either from the water, the sea, the air. You understand nature when you eat there. It's very, very special. But the place that calls me back, that I can't wait to have again, Kikambo Ramen.
Ooh.
Have you been there?
No, I have not. Luckily.
Very spicy.
I guess.
Now, you can have mild if you want. I got, I think, the medium. It was very spicy for me, right on the edge of too much. But my forehead was sweating. You know, my nose is running. My eyes are tearing. My lips are burning. But it was so delicious that I couldn't stop.
Wow.
You know, when something is spicy, it produces endorphins in your brain, the same like you get when what they call the runner's high, or when you're in love, or when you have chocolate, you know?
Wow. I didn't know that effect.
Spicy food. Yes.
Wow.
If it's too hot, then it's just painful. But if it's just on the edge, perfect, like these geniuses have mastered, then it becomes one of your favorite things.
Okay, so that sounds addictive.
It is addictive. In fact, that's the one place that I want to go back to first.
Wow.
Yes.
Impressive. I thought you were suffering quite a bit.
But happy suffering. Yeah, not terrible.
Okay.
I was sweating and everything, but it was so delicious I had to keep going. I finished the whole thing.
Wow. Okay, so I'll go there next time.
Good.
Kikambo.
Good.
So one more.
Sure, anything.
One more place where you're gonna
go. One more place. Let's see. I'm trying to remember all the places I went in Tokyo. This is now a couple of years ago.
For instance, I think...
Well, Den would be the other one. That's a spectacular experience.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you all watch that episode. I'll Have What Phil's Having is also on Netflix, so you can see it there too. It's the same show.
Right.
It's just had a different title because it started on PBS.
Okay. So, yeah, Zayu Hasegawa, he's like a team player. So the whole restaurant, I think, is like a theater. That's what
it is. Do you know when we said goodbye, and it was lovely... We walked down the street outside of the place as we were walking away from the restaurant. When we turned back, the entire staff of the restaurant, six or seven people, were standing in the doorway of Den, still waving goodbye to us. It was the most charming thing I've ever seen.
Right.
They didn't even know if we would turn around again. They just were there waving,
right.
Almost as a ritual.
Well, however, I
yes.
think this is pretty standard for Japanese traditional. Because, for instance, I happened to go to one of those classic restaurants, New York version, last night.
Yes.
And then the whole team was waving for me when I left.
What's the name of the restaurant?
The new place is called the Yamada Chikara. It's a really new place.
Okay, so I go to sushi bars all the time. I go to Japanese restaurants all the time in America, in Los Angeles especially, where the sushi's very, very good. Nobody's ever waved goodbye to me there.
I think that actually the intention of the chef is to bring that culture
yes.
to New York.
Great.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be sweet if everybody could do that? I understand why they can't. They're very busy. But you feel very special. And look how years later, I still remember this gesture.
Right.
It's lovely.
Mm-hmm. So it's a loyalty. Like you really want to be there whenever you get a chance.
It's Tokyo. I haven't been all over Japan. In fact, that's the only place I've been to in Japan.
Mm.
But it's the most food-centric place I've ever been. Every other doorway in Tokyo seems to be have something to do with food.
Right. We are food-obsessed.
Food-obsessed. And then you have the crazy pop culture commercial variations that we don't have. For instance, flavors of potato chips or Kit Kat bars in many, 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 many different flavors. They become a cult obsession. So the food itself is part of pop culture, the way a new song would be on the radio.
Right.
The different, the new flavor is here.
So I think in the Japanese nature, if you see something, you have to keep inventing new.
Yes.
And perfect it.
I don't know. It's something there. It's, I love a culture like this. Even if it's not mine, but that's what makes the world beautiful, isn't it? That we have all these differences.
Well, we share everything. That's why this country invented a Californian roll. So I think
that's right.
It's a part of Japanese culture now.
There was a very famous sushi chef. He's still alive, but he stopped working, named Nozawa in Los Angeles. Did you know him?
Right. The original.
The original. He refused to serve a California roll. He refused to serve a spicy tuna roll. These were not authentic Japanese creations. And sometimes Californians, Los Angeles people, would insist on having them because that's what they were most comfortable with. And he would say, I'm sorry, we don't do that. There's even a sign on the wall, no California roll, no spicy tuna. And it said, instead of that, it said, today's special, trust me. Which I did. Because he taught me about sushi. He really taught me because I was very interested. He could be very harsh. In fact, if you asked more than once for the California roll, he would say, get out.
Oh, no, you're prohibited.
Get out.
Oh, my God.
He would say, get out if you asked somebody to move their chair so you could sit next to your person. Get out.
Well, maybe that's the key to preserve the tradition so stubbornly, like Japanese
culture. I think it's all about personality, his particular personality. But he is a genius, and he taught many, many chefs the right way to do sushi.
Right. Wow. So now that's why there are so many expensive sushi restaurants that can survive in this economy in whole
people
United
value
States.
It. First of all, it's healthy. And second of all, it's delicious.
Right. Okay. So the other thing about your show is that on each episode, you always seem to have rich cultural experience through local people. So did you have any interesting human encounter in Tokyo?
Always, yes. Our friend Yukari, she's half Japanese, half, is it Montana, maybe?
Something like
Something like that. And she lives with her Japanese husband who used to work at
Tsukiji.
The fish market, And so I had a meal in their home, which was wonderful for me. And I saw all these kind of, you know, the Japanese apartments are small because space is limited. But the imagination it takes to make it a home, like here was a brilliant thing. The bathroom in their home, there is a sink, there is a spout over the tank, over the toilet. So, you flush the toilet, and the water comes out of the spout for you to wash your hands in that water, which then goes into the tank to fill for the next flush. Genius, I thought.
You don't
we do that?
Right.
Why don't we do that? That's brilliant.
Well, yeah, here in America, you have a space to create, build a sink.
Yes.
And in Japan, we don't, so...
Well, for just for that purpose, it saves water, it saves space.
Right.
It's very smart.
Yeah, eco-friendly.
Yeah, economically.
Well, That's interesting. You notice that kind of thing. That's
of course
so
I notice, because we see whenever you see something that's brilliant that you don't have at home, you notice and you remember.
I took it for granted.
You did.
Yeah. When I grew up, like, oh, there's no water coming out of the toilet.
But isn't that smart? Shouldn't everybody do that? Right. That's the first thing I think. Listen, when I was in Paris, I saw that not only do they have the bike rentals, they have electric car rentals where you pick them up and drop them off on the street, the electric car, and you plug it in. Instead of just parking it in the in the space for the next person, you plug it in and then it gets charged. And then look at all the good that does. Mm. Why don't we have this?
Right. So through traveling, not just food, you can just steal all those good things and share in your own culture.
You can't just eat all the time.
Right. That's true.
You have to do something in between meals anyway. Mm. So you may as well look around.
Right. So, and you had lot of footages, I'm sure, like, you know, when you travel, for instance, Tokyo, I mean, I don't know, the show was only 1 hour, so you have so many footages. Oh, yeah, right.
10 days of filming. Yeah.
So is there anything I cannot see on the screen, but you want to share?
I'm trying to think. Most of the things are fine, ordinary, maybe a few things that I'm not so crazy about. So I don't include them because I want to show you the best because I want you to travel.
Mm.
So people sometimes say, Phil, it looks like you love everything. Well, I do love everything that I'm showing you. Otherwise, I wouldn't show it to you.
Right. That's true. That makes
sense.
So
you see me excited because these were the things I was most excited about. Mm. People forget that there's editing.
Right.
That we put the show together from 10 days of footage. Mm. You're seeing our favorite moments.
Right. So hopefully you didn't suffer too much at the...
I did not. I could do 3 or 4 episodes just on Tokyo.
Mm.
And then I'm dying to go to Kyoto.
Right. I was going to suggest.
That looks very beautiful. Mm. So, you know, if we're lucky enough to get to do more episodes, that's definitely a stop.
Mm.
There's a lot of places in Asia to go.
Right. Yeah. They have like 195 countries in the world.
Wow.
So.
Got to get to them.
Right. And at the end of the Tokyo episode, you say, I've gone from I didn't get it to I'm starting to get it. So why do you mean by that?
Exactly what I said at the beginning, where I was afraid at the beginning. Look at this. Look at how crazy and chaotic it is.
Mm, like Shibuya crossing.
Exactly. I didn't understand it. Why would you want to live in such a place?
Mm.
And then I understood everything the place had to offer. Mm. And we shouldn't be so quick to judge.
Mm,
right?
Right.
The beauty and care that people take in what they can control in their lives is reason alone to go.
Right. That's true.
Because you take that with you, that lesson.
Right. So you may want to keep going back to Tokyo itself because...
Yes, I could go back every year and be very happy.
Right. Because one thing I noticed at the Shibuya crossing,
yes,
it's chaotic, but... There's
an order.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Right. So I don't know exactly how the mental magic works in all those people.
Of the crossing?
Yeah.
I know how. They follow the signs.
That is true.
Right?
Yeah. There's no jaywalk in Japan, by the way.
There is no jaywalk. I think if you jaywalk, you're dead.
Yeah.
Because the people are following the signs.
Mm.
Cross now.
Right.
Stop now. You have 5 more seconds before the cars are coming.
Right. And also, you get the whole, you know, eyes of despise.
That's right.
So that stopped me from doing it in Japan.
Yeah.
All right. So now we take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the newest season of Somebody Feel Phil, which came out just last week on Friday. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat.
Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Phil Rosenthal, who is the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, and now the creator of the two fantastic food travel shows called I'll Have What Phil's Having and Somebody Feed Phil. So let's talk about Somebody Feed Phil, which came after I'll Have What Phil's Having. And so the I'll Have What Phil's Having and Somebody Feed Phil, they are basically the same.
Yes.
Okay, so
I'll Have What Phil's Having was made for PBS a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and then Netflix came along and picked up the show and changed the name.
Mm.
But it's the same show.
Right. Okay. So the first season of Somebody Feed Phil came out in January 2018 with 6 episodes, which I quickly finished watching.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to Bangkok, Saigon, Tel Aviv, Lisbon, New Orleans, Mexico City. And second season... it just came out last Friday.
Yeah.
So where are we going?
Copenhagen,
mm-hmm.
Dublin, Buenos Aires, Venice, Cape Town, and New York.
New York.
Yes.
So, but by the way, how do you select all those destinations?
Oh, if I'm trying to get Americans to travel, I'm starting with what I think of as Earth's greatest hits.
Right.
The most popular place on Earth, and for Americans, the most accessible.
Mm.
Places where most people speak English. You'll have a hotel, there'll be a bed, there'll be a pillow, there'll be food that you at least recognize if you live in a city.
Right.
2/3 of Americans don't have a passport.
Wow, that many.
That many. And that's including everyone who came to America with a passport.
Mm.
And only 10% of those people use their passport.
Huh.
So I think that the world would be better if everyone traveled a little and experienced other people's experiences.
Mm, and find different toilet system.
That's right. And different ways to live life and different ways to appreciate life.
Mm.
I'm not saying that if you go to Japan, you should come back and start acting the way they do in Japan. But you might get a little insight into a different way of thinking that might enrich your life, that you can apply to your life.
Right. So out of the season two, which
yes.
actually, the second course, the first season was called the first course.
Yes.
So the second course, what
yes.
kind of like cultural discovery did you have?
Wow. Well, so many. Every place you make a cultural discovery,
right?
Even if it's just, look how similar it is to ours. But, you know, when you go to Europe, let's say, they take a time out of the day. Like from 2 to 4 o'clock, you can't go shopping.
Mm.
They shut down.
Right.
At first, I thought, one of my first trips in the 1980s, when I first went, I'm like, this is crazy.
Mm.
Why would they shut down? And then a day or two later, I start to understand, oh, they want to enjoy the day. We don't even understand this concept in America of taking prime time out of the day to enjoy the day, and then they stay open a little bit later.
It's a life priority.
Exactly right.
Mm.
So shouldn't we all make life a priority?
Right.
You know, it's like in New York. One of the most beautiful things in New York is Central Park, mm-hmm. and I make a big deal about it in the show. Here is some of the most expensive real estate on the planet that's been left alone as free space for the people to enjoy life, a life priority. Mm. We're going to take this. They could make a fortune just taking a tiny chunk out of it and selling it.
Right.
Nope. You cannot touch it. This is for the people. Mm. Rich or poor, any color, any place, anywhere, you can come and enjoy Central Park for free.
But can you imagine how much creativity or rest or energy that park can create for human beings that spend time in
the park?
Can
you imagine how much has already been created in the world from people sitting in Central Park?
Right.
So it's one of my favorite places in the world. And it's because it embodies this spirit of taking that time and space.
Right.
And devoting it to the enjoyment of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because imagine New York without it. Unrelenting grid of city.
That is true.
Right?
And it's a, like you said, it's a point. It's in the middle of the city.
The middle. The most prime real estate maybe in the world is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful park.
Right. That reminds me about, you went to Paris and you spent time at the Café Margaux.
Yes.
And it's not just a café drinking coffee or pastries. It's about how you spend your time.
Yes.
In your life.
The tables and the seats face outward onto the street and the sidewalk, and you see life going by. And there's nothing nicer than sitting with your coffee or your hot chocolate and your pastry and just sitting on a beautiful day and watching Paris. That's pretty good activity, right? So we have that in America too. We have it in Japan. We have it everywhere. This seems to be a universal luxury to sit and watch the world.
I think we need more though in this country.
Why not?
Right. And also the habit or the, you know, the custom of spending some time. It's okay. You don't have to rush to Starbucks and just pretending you're working on the computer, but you can just stop, shut the computer. Just have some nice cup of tea or coffee.
Did you see the Hong Kong episode of I'll Have What Phil's Having?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the section where I went to the tea house in the park and I sat with the master, the tea master, and he explained that a few times a day there's this tea ritual where that he goes through the process of making the tea and pouring it this exact way and letting it sit and letting and sipping the first taste quickly and then letting it rest and then sipping. He says all of this is kind of a waste of time. But it's important every day to waste some time.
That's called meditation, maybe?
Yes. It is kind of a meditation where you're focused on this task, this beautiful task, and you're completely immersed in it, and you're not looking at your phone.
Right, you can't do that with
you're
spending time with tea.
Exactly.
Right.
And then all the nutritive properties of tea and how beneficial it is for us. This is just a widely known fact now, how good tea is for you.
Right. Interesting. I think in this country, you know, it's like having a good coffee is good, but there's always information online. Drinking too much coffee is bad. Like a glass of wine, but wine is bad. Or something like, it's always something negative associated with any beverage or any food in this country. It's too much because everybody's too health conscious.
Yes.
Because we are doing so much unhealthy things, too much work.
Yes. I've never heard a bad word about tea.
Oh, okay.
Never. Have you?
Nope, actually not.
In fact, I love coffee. I'm drinking coffee right now because it wakes you up. But it wakes you up quickly and then it crashes you. Tea is a slow build.
Right.
It just keeps you nice level. It's a slow release caffeine.
Right.
So it keeps you maybe not as powerfully awake as coffee does right away, but slowly and steadily.
Right. I think that's the chemical called the theanine.
Yes.
It works with caffeine, so it's like controlling each other.
Yes.
And it takes, like, instead of like 2 hours, it takes like 4 hours, six
yes.
hours.
And he told me, this tea master, that the polyphenols in tea are the most beneficial part. And you know what destroys the polyphenols? If you put milk in your tea.
Oh, I
don't
didn't
put
know
milk
that
in your tea, he told me.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't know.
I didn't either until he told me.
Wow.
Yes. It kills all the nutritive properties of tea.
So British people.
Very interesting, right?
Yeah, I don't know how British people
maybe they
do
shouldn't
it
be so quick to colonize places.
Yeah, that's another topic we should discuss. Okay, so yeah, one thing I really enjoy about your show is that you connect people watching and the local people on the show.
Yeah.
Like when you went to Tel Aviv, I was like, to be honest, I had no interest to visit the city. But then once I started watching, it's like, oh no, when should I go? What's the best month to be there? It's that kind of thing.
I love that.
But what's your purpose to do the show ultimately? To me, you're doing something far beyond showing food on the plate.
Then you've answered the question. That's what I'm doing. It's a show about human connection.
Mm.
It's disguised as a food and travel show.
Mm.
I think the purpose of the show is to get you to travel.
Mm.
Not only will it make the world better, not only does the world need you to travel, meaning a nice person to go and represent us.
Mm.
Not only is that very, very necessary, but because of selfishly what it will do for you. Because when you travel, your mind will be expanded. You can't help it.
Mm.
And it's something that once your mind is expanded, it stays expanded.
Mm.
You will now return home with this new insight into life. And you can't buy that.
Mm.
It's not a car you can buy. It's not a big TV you can buy. It's not a toy you can buy.
Mm.
It's not jewelry you can buy. You've invested in your mind.
Mm.
And your mind is going to stay with you for a while.
Right. And especially so, when you do it with people,
yes,
you think of the country, but you think of more person you spoke to.
To me, this is the main thing, connecting with the people. The food is just the connection that we make.
Right.
And I believe that we connect over food. Mm. And then for me, from where I'm from and for what I do, laughs are then the cement to the people.
Right.
Because if you and I eat together, hopefully we at least are not hurting each other. we're eating. We
right.
have to eat. And we all know what that is. It's universal.
Mm.
We all have to eat. And most people, you know, eat with someone else.
Mm.
At least one meal a day.
Right.
Okay. But then if we share a laugh, some humor of any kind, not saying I'm as funny as you or you're as funny as me, but we appreciate each other's sense of humor.
Mm.
Now we are friends.
Right.
That's everything.
Mm.
And I say to Americans, instead of a wall, how about a table?
Mm, that is so true. Because you naturally become happier over good food.
Yes, you do.
And the laughter, I think sharing laughter has to be something very connecting. Because if you are separate, you can share the same kind of jokes
yes.
or humor. So.
Yes, but even I'm meeting people who don't speak English and I don't speak their language, but somehow we find a way to smile or laugh together.
Right.
You can do it. It's very easy.
Right. So are you planning to do more shows after the second course?
Planning. Yes, I have to see if Netflix wants me to do some more.
I hope so. Maybe I should call up the Netflix and please.
I think everyone listening should call Netflix.
Yeah.
Don't tell them I told you to do that. But you, yes.
Okay, it's a secret. So
okay.
Well, right. And hopefully you're going to do the Kyoto episode.
I can't wait. Maybe you have to meet me there and show me around.
Okay.
Yes?
Yeah, I'm in.
It's a date.
All right. So, okay, so where can we find your update online? Like all those social. Oh,
very good. Okay, so I'm on Twitter, Phil Rosenthal,
Phil.Rosenthal,
Instagram, official Phil Rosenthal on Facebook. And now, today, we are announcing a website that has everywhere we went on the shows.
Oh my God.
So it's all the restaurants, all the locations, the addresses, how to make a reservation. It's all there, wow. Plus deleted scenes from the show and other things that I'm working on. It's called PhilRosenthalWorld.com.
Wow.
PhilRosenthalWorld.com. So people are writing to me, what was the name of that place? What did you order there? Now I can point them to somewhere.
You can save a lot of time by doing
it. PhilRosenthalWorld.com.
Right. Okay, I'll bookmark it. So, all right. So thank you for joining us today, Phil.
Oh, I loved it.
Everybody loves Phil.
Oh, sweet. I love meeting you.
Thank you. And please continue traveling and eating for all of us.
Okay.
All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is David Tatashiro. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.